I'll never forget the first moment when I walked in Curious Cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Hello and welcome to the 16th Skin On podcast of our relaunch in 2018. So I'm back. Hey! So I'm Niall, for those of you who have missed me for the last couple of weeks, and I'm joined by Darren.
Hello!
And by Alex.
Hello!
Yes, and so we'll kick off as per usual what we've been watching recently. I'm going to go clockwise, so I'll start with Darren.
I'm not used to starting this. So I rewatched Fargo at the weekend because obviously the TV series was on. My family are watching it, so we figured we'd sit down and watch Fargo because we hadn't seen it in years. Still as good as it ever was, and still fantastic, and still kind of brilliant. And this wonderful, watching it after watching the show, you do get this sort of weird sense of like, that Holly has sort of created this weird shared cinematic universe in the sense that we talk about like Marvel movies, which I'm sure we will later on, out of Fargo, where he's extended motifs and characters and themes and all this sort of stuff across, yeah, I think it's what, 30 episodes, 10 episodes a season roughly, from this 2-hour film, which is remarkable. It also suggests how wonderfully sort of dense it is. But one of the best things about Fargo is the idea that the Coen brothers have always been accused of being vaguely nihilistic in terms of the stories that they tell. And that was one of the popular criticisms in the early 90s, the point where I suspect that the nihilist characters in The Big Lebowski were very much intended as the Coen brothers sticking up two middle fingers at them. And then, of course, they made A Serious Man in the Noughties, but that's not really this thing. But with Fargo, there's a real earnestness and sincerity to it, in that it's a story that's very much about good and evil at work in the world, where evil is presented as greedy, petty, short-sighted, vindictive, with no real focus, no real attention to detail. It's messy, it's clumsy, and it's horrible. And in contrast to that, you have Marge Gunderson, who is portrayed as the force of good. And in the world of Fargo, being good is not being clever or being astute or being smart or being witty. Marge is you know, she works hard. She's not particularly bright. She's not the top of her field. She's not an expert in any particular thing. What she has is she has an attention to detail and a sincerity. Like, there's a moment where she's interviewing William H. Macy, and it's becoming very clear that, you know, she's building towards finding out that he's implicated in the crime. He excuses himself to go out and individually check the car registration plates, and she lets him go. And then he runs off, like the shot is him driving away frantically from the used car lot. So like, Marge isn't particularly like astute or brilliant as a detective in those terms, but what she is she works hard. She pays attention to detail. She puts in the groundwork. She's considerate of other people and she's thoughtful. And there's this wonderful sense watching Fargo that while good won't always triumph in an absolute sense over evil, it will win out in the end because it is careful and meticulous, and you know, it has that attention that evil lacks. And there's something very heartwarming in that, despite this is the movie where, you know, one of the primary characters ends up fed into a wood chipper. But there's something very warm. And
it does give you that Last Jedi-esque red against white
contrast, yeah, but, sort of the Kurosawa-esque sort of contrast that you get. But it's an absolutely beautiful film, and I'm really, really glad that I rewatched it.
Beautiful overhead shots in it. It uses
the environment
very, very well.
Yeah,
it's my favorite Combs.
Really?
Yeah.
I think it would be mine as well, actually.
Okay. I feel kind of bad that I brought it up, because I'd be like Big Lebowski all the way. But yeah, it's certainly up there. It's one of the best movies of the 90s and one of the best Coen Brothers films. Mm. I also rewatched Blade Runner 2049.
Oh, yeah.
Which is still a very flawed, very beautiful film.
Very long film.
Well, that was Ridley Scott's.
That was wonderful, the interview he gave, where he just sort of said it was far too long and laughed.
Far too long, laughed, and said that was kind of my fault, and then continued laughing.
Yeah.
I love that Ridley Scott's reached this sort of age where he can just say shit and not have to worry about PR afterwards. But yeah, it is very long.
It depends on what he's saying. Some of the film directors of his age should not be allowed unfiltered.
Yeah.
Okay. So
sometimes he's close to making a good point and then will immediately undo that point by just sort of reverting to the kind of like older kind of
grumpy.
I remember when somebody sort of leveled a valid criticism at Exodus: Gods and Kings, which the fact that
all the criticism is valid,
but this particular point that sort of said, you know, that you're setting a film in Africa and you've got the likes of a Welshman, Christian Bale, and an Australian. And playing all these characters, and he sort of said, I'd love to be able to cast minority actors, but I can't make a film of this scale and get it past the money guys. No one's going to go see a film if Muhammad, whatever his name is, and instantly you're like, you were close to making an interesting observation
about how the industry works, and then you just throw in the casual racism.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that,
in fairness, he is Landon Gentry British. So.
Yeah.
And he's 80 or something like that, isn't he?
Yeah, so.
Which, and remarkable given how quick his turnaround is. And like the accomplishment.
He's sort of Britain.
That's it, pretty much it. That's actually a pretty good description of what he is. I mean, whatever about all the money in the world and how messy and not great the film is.
In fairness, given what he did, it's a remarkably coherent film.
Seamless film, considering the...
But it's a seamless film because one imagines the flaws that were initially there were, like, so the fractures were so perfectly positioned in the original concept of the film that he could do what he had to do.
Yeah.
Like, if you had watched that with Kevin Spacey in the same role, it would still seem fractured and uneven. It just wouldn't have an excuse.
I see what you mean, yeah. That's probably true.
You wouldn't be willing to give it the pass.
Yeah. And I think it's entirely deserving the pass. I think it's a fantastic technical accomplishment. But yeah, Blade Runner 2049 is beautiful. It's wonderful. It's long. It has some very serious issues. Those issues are inevitably tied up with what makes it so good. So, for example, its treatment of women, which is not great, where every woman in the movie is either a dead mother figure, a stern, cold mother figure, or a fantasy love bot slash prostitute.
Yeah, I was going to say prostitute is the
third. Yeah, is the third type of woman who appears in Blade Runner 2049. And while there's a sense that, you know, the movie is making some point about capitalism and consumerism and the culture in which we live, it's also a movie that's like 3 hours long and can't think of a woman who doesn't fit into one of those three categories.
Mm.
Same thing with the length of the film, where you have the length that's far too long, but it's also that length is used in such a way that you get this wonderful setup of a chosen one and like a revolutionary narrative. And then it sort of subverts that and becomes this weird, intimate, like father-daughter sort of more personal narrative, which is brutal and clever and brilliant and could only work with a film that is as long as it is, but that doesn't change the fact that it's still very, very long.
Mm.
But yeah, it's absolutely, it's beautiful, but yeah, deeply, deeply flawed. And then finally I watched a bunch of Marvel movies for reasons that I'm sure we'll talk about when we get to the top 10, I suspect.
I watched one of them that you watched as well.
Oh, so I watched Age of Ultron and Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
Yeah, Age of Ultron is one I watched.
So I was thinking of watching Guardians of the Galaxy 2 because I haven't seen it since the cinema and didn't love it when I saw it then. In the same way I loved the first one, so kind of interested in a rewatch, maybe.
It's a deeply, deeply flawed film. It's an interesting film. It's, in many ways, it's you have those difficult second movies in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where you have, obviously, Age of Ultron, which we'll probably talk about in a second.
Civil War, that was tough, you know. Yeah,
okay, but Iron Man 2, for example, The Dark World, and this. But I quite admire certain aspects of Guardians 2, where it's like... the first movie is about this kid who loses his mother and drifts off into a fantasy with a green woman and a talking raccoon. And that's very beautiful and very elegant. Mm. And weirdly personal. Mm. And so the second movie then is about him discovering his deadbeat dad, who's living in this cool house with this much younger girl. And he wants to bring him back into his life, but really he's an egomaniacal monster who only sees himself and his children. And so you get that sort of interesting dynamic at play there.
Quite literally wants to turn his children into himself.
Oh, yeah.
Quite literally.
yeah. Well, that's what superhero movies do. They literalize sort of like life lessons or metaphors. And I think it works quite well there. It just has some really, really terrible tonal issues.
Yes.
Particularly in the subplot involving the talking raccoon. There's like moments where it seems to be going for goofy, like high concept space comedy like the first one was, while it's shoving sympathetic secondary characters out the airlock and watching them freeze to death in the cold void of space.
And home aloneing them on a desert planet or on a forest planet as well. Like that sequence is just... I mean, it's funny, but I mean...
I couldn't get over the violence and not to sound like Maude Flanders, but I do remember being in that cinema and looking around at the, you know, 8-year-olds and...
baying for blood!
Yeah, and the scenes that are inevitably set to some cool 70s song where he's just slaughtering people.
Yeah, the bit where he's massacring the crew with the arrow while... Yeah.
Or in that scene in the forest where he's basically taking a bunch of people and slamming them repeatedly against the ground from about 30 feet.
Yeah.
And yet none of them suffer any injuries.
And he's laughing. And presumably the audience are laughing as well if it's anything like that. I remember
there's Wile E. Coyote physics going on in that scene.
But, I mean, it's weird because you get that and then you also get like Murder Space Pirates. And it doesn't quite work in that level. But it is... interesting. Kurt Russell's fantastic in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a much stronger emotional core, I think, than many of the Marvel movies around that time.
Yeah, it does go a little Pirates of the Caribbean, though.
When you say that, you mean...
When all the different lead captains of all the ships turn up.
You know. I actually really liked that. I thought the David Hasselhoff in-joke was a bit too much, but I liked the fiery Viking funeral.
The Cat Stevens song.
Yeah, with 80s icons showing up to salute Michael Rooker. It's like, I feel like this is quite like Michael Rooker's real funeral would be.
I don't mind that, but it is sort of setting it up to go down the, you know, at world's end, really.
Yeah.
And that worries me.
I remember thinking that it's always a good sign, and I know it's probably something that's more relevant for television shows, but when you've written a very good television show, you know you're onto a good thing when you can put combinations of different characters and focus on them for a particular episode, and it still works and it's still good. I thought with Guardians of the Galaxy Vol. 2, I remember thinking that they kind of split the family up essentially into like two different storylines, and finding like, as the film went on, realizing, wait, they're not all going to get back up together again in time for like, you know, they're going to spend most of the film apart.
Yeah.
And thinking it was a strange choice for a franchise in that particular story that had sort of built up so much goodwill about them as a group to then split them.
That's the Empire approach, or that's what Bryan Singer did with X-Men 2 as well, where you diffuse the cast and you bring them back together for like the third film in theory, if you're doing it. The issue is that this one crowns it in the end.
At no point in X1 or X2 do you care about the X-Men as a collective.
No, you care about the individual character arcs as they're going. Yeah, which is
whereas I think in Guardians, it's the group. You're following one particular character, you're kind of like, can't wait till they get back into a scrapes as a group.
Yeah, I suppose. We'll probably talk about Age of Ultron when we get around to you then.
We can both talk about Age of Ultron. It doesn't matter about the order.
Age of Ultron is a deeply, deeply flawed, deeply, deeply interesting film. It's
remarkable looking film as well. It sets the scene for a lot of the look that follows in later on.
It's also, I would argue, a much more cinematic film than the two Avengers films that have followed, which are Captain America: Civil War and Infinity War. In that it's got Whedon is still, he's a television showrunner. He transitioned to film with Serenity and stuff like that. He obviously did Much Ado About Nothing. But there's a much more visual feel of it in terms of there's a lot of showy long takes. There's that, you know, long take in Sokovia where they spin around the room that's designed to recreate like a Brian Hitch sort of 8-page spread. It's excess, but if you can't do excess in your gigantic like multi-character crossover, when are you going to do it? And there's also one of the things watching this and having watched the two Russo Brothers Avengers films afterwards is that Whedon's Avengers are assholes, and that's kind of what makes them work, is that every single character in that group is flawed, and even Captain America is a bit of a jerk. He feels like a guy who went into the ice in 1940 and woke up a bit. It's kind of that Mark Miller-esque sort of like conservative, watch your language, you kiss your mother with that mouth sort of attitude. And you have that sort of thing going on, which you don't really get in the Russo Brothers films, where he's just generic nice guy.
Yeah.
And you have that with Tony Stark with like creating Ultron, which is a decision which is absolutely terrible and is like the heroes create their own worst enemy sort of nonsense. But it's also a decision that feels rooted in his character arc as it flows, in that he's a guy, he's got a huge ego. He wants to retire based on Iron Man 3, and he projects his own need for a suit of armor to the entire planet. So it makes sense that he would create a giant machine with an ego much like his.
Oh yeah, and for the second film in a row, it shows him pushing all of Mark Ruffalo's buttons in order to get him to acquiesce to his plan. That he has a second person.
Yeah. Well, he has an ego, basically, because there's a Frankenstein sequence in the middle of the film with Vision.
But well, one of the things that you're saying about all of the characters being essentially dickheads, like to an extent, or at least being
distinct personalities,
that's actually visualized when none of them can lift a hammer, and the closest that comes to it is apparently the pure
Captain
America, and
I feel like in Civil War he would pick up the hammer and hit Iron Man with it almost. But there's this interesting sort of dynamic at play, and there's this thing that runs through the film. It's a messy, very ugly film, and you can feel the wrestling that's taking place between Whedon and the studio, which is quite similar to what you get when you watch Iron Man 2, where you can feel Favreau wrestling against the studio. And you can see the movie that Whedon wants to make, which is this weird reflection on, like, mortality and children and the next generation, and this idea that, you know, he's making a comic book movie about characters who will never be allowed to grow old and die, who will never face mortality, who will never be able to, like, reproduce and have a family in a conventional sense. So when they do, they end up creating, like, monstrous robots and evil mutants and all this sort of stuff. Hawkeye has to have, like, a family that exists outside the narrative of the film, to the point where they may as well have, like, wandered into a Norman Rockwell painting when they go and visit him. But then you also have all the Marvel stuff that's crammed in on top, and you have this weird situation where, like, the plot points out, the plot is based on the absurdity and the futility of like, comic book storytelling, where Tony creates a problem by, you know, making an artificial intelligence protect the world. How does Tony solve this problem in Age of Ultron? He creates an artificial intelligence to protect the world. It's almost tragic, this sense that the characters sort of stuck in this repeating loop because they can't grow or change or evolve. You have, for example, Natasha being sterilized. You have the whole, you know, Mark Ruffalo saying he can't biologically have kids. You have Tony's...
I forgot some of that, yeah. Yeah, like, some of that was brutal, man.
A lot of it is all ground for Whedon as well. A lot of it has comes from Buffy.
Yeah.
In terms of that, the hero trapped in a never-ending cycle.
Yeah.
Is very goofy in that, you know. So.
And it's interesting because I watched it after, or I watched it between watchings of Infinity War. And it's interesting because Infinity War in many ways hits on some of the same buttons in a much more corporate friendly, much less sort of, this is maybe a bad thing sort of way. In that, like, if Infinity War is arguably about the embodiment of mortality chasing down these heroes and how it will be terrible if it caught them, whereas Age of Ultron is kind of like, maybe if these people were allowed to grow up, it wouldn't be the worst thing. And so you have the kind of interesting back and forth. And I think that Age of Ultron is not a particularly good film, but I think it's a much more interesting film than the smoother films that have followed, the sort of easier production line films, the streamlined ones with all the edges taken off. Like, I feel like, for example, Civil War's treatment of Tony Stark, where he's not allowed to even believe in what he's doing, because if he believed in what he's doing, the audience couldn't root for him and they might hate him. So he has to instead become this lackey to the obviously evil military general played by William Hurt, who really believes in, like, accountability and crazy concepts like that. And I feel like, you know, kind of lost something in smoothing that out.
Yeah, well, one of the things that Ultron does is, and I'm coming at this from a parent's perspective, the only character in it who actually is a parent is left minding the children. You know, because he's the only one who actually will assume responsibility for children. The others are off chasing their own creations or doing whatever else it is. But they're the actual children that are in danger are being protected by the father.
Well, I mean, that happens a bit as well. Like, I mean, even Ultron, when he's dying, you know, tells Wanda to get out because, you know, she'll die. And there is even, like, a sense of, like, bad parents are still parents in there.
James Spader was also an interesting casting. I remember when he was that being like, ooh, okay.
Well, if you were to take Robert Downey Jr. and strip out all the decency, you'd probably end up with
And it's
Spader.
Funny, because there's, like, there's this terrible 1980s adaptation of a Bret Easton Ellis novel, and in it, Robert Downey Jr. is playing this sort of, like, you know, coked out loser, but the evil guy is played by young James Spader, and, like, even worse coked out loser.
Yeah,
and
that's exactly what they're going for here. So yeah, it's the Bret Easton Ellis movie of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But yeah.
Oh, could you imagine? Imagine Bret Easton Ellis was let near
any of those characters.
Movie. Oh.
Tell me you wouldn't watch that, and tell me you wouldn't rewatch that.
Robert Downey Jr. would have a ball.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Shane Black one worked quite well, right?
Yeah, I liked the Shane Black one. More of that kind of stuff.
Alright, but that's me anyway.
Yeah, no, and I mean, for me, Ultron is yeah, you're right. That's too long again. It is trying to solve all of the problems with all the superhero movies in one but foul swoop. It's like, oh no, we never think about the collateral damage, you know, films, and then suddenly it's like, that's all
I think about. I admire that. I admire the fact that Whedon, like, took a note on Man of Steel, where he's like, okay, we can do 9/11 damage, but maybe our hero should be, like, concerned with people getting thrown off at tremendous heights. Just throwing it out there.
Yeah. And but the entire sequence in the middle when Iron Man takes on the Hulk is just brilliant.
You mean on the African coast?
Yeah.
It's the generic African.
Why not just put Lagos? What does it matter?
I don't know. You worry sometimes that there's been a whole meeting about that and being like,
Lagos confuses people.
You understand how long the coastline of Africa is, right?
Africa is not a small island. But I do like the idea that, they're like, so when we say London, are we going to put comma England afterwards?
Yeah. The North American city,
North American coastline.
That would actually, that'd be a lot of fun. The North American coastline could be, because it could be anything.
Yeah, really could.
There's so much coastline in Canada. It's just unaccounted for. I don't know. But no, Ultron, that moment when Ultron is born and he turns up in the room and they're like,
There are no strings on me, which is Whedon sort of gently mocking the Disney acquisition.
Ironically, though, given that Disney's dictating terms of the actual film, there are no strings on me, and turns out a lot of strings on his contract and what he could or could not do.
One imagines that was like, he got a call into the office and he's like, you see this, Whedon?
He did not have a good time
He talks about how the Thor flash forward sequence where Thor is more concerned about the death of Asgard than he may be in future Avenger movies, that was basically ransomed into the film at the extent of the entire Hawkeye family sequence.
Really?
Yeah.
And is that part of the world building then?
That is
part of having Idris Elba set up.
Yeah,
that, right?
It was so that he could start explaining about Infinity Stones to everybody else. I mean,
poor Thor. No wonder Chris Hemsworth wanted to die that after before Ragnarok.
Captain Exposition, as he turns into in Ultron. How about you, Alex?
I saw two films recently enough. First one, partly because it's been on my list for years, partly because Darren recorded a podcast about it recently, and partly because the director died fairly recently. Amadeus, yes. I saw Amadeus for the first time. It's interesting finding someone else to want to watch Amadeus with you, because apparently Irish secondary school music classes, everyone would just sort of get this film on a loop. So I talked to a few people about this, and they're like, oh, I could never watch that again, given it being
the trauma
I saw it in secondary school. But I really liked it. I went in knowing not that much about it, other than I really liked the director. And knowing as well that... I suppose I didn't really, because I wasn't particularly familiar with the two actors outside of the work they'd sort of, particularly F. Murray Abraham had done in more modern films like Inside Llewyn Davis, where he shows up and is this very interesting presence, but I'm always kind of thinking, that guy. And then you'd see him in Scarface and I want to see more of that guy. And
well, don't worry, we have a perfect Star Trek movie for you.
But in terms of this one, I think I went into it thinking it was going to be one of these sort of prestige Oscar films, because I knew it had won a lot of sort of acting awards and had gotten on a lot of very prestigious lists, the top 50, these kind of films. So I really went in thinking this was going to be quite a sort of, maybe a little bit of a stay period epic. And right from the start, when that New York actor with a really great face, Vincent Schnelli, he shows up and he's just talking with his Brooklyn accent and he says something hilarious like, we gotta get Salaria's pudding. And I was like, no, this is different. This is really its own weird thing. And the rest of the film is so sort of in keeping with that kind of play fast and loose with the facts. Doesn't really matter in terms if, Solari was there for this or not, or let's just completely impugn his character because it's a great story.
The five Solari fans are still outraged.
I know, And I really liked it. I thought it, for a film that, and I watched the director's cut, it was a really interesting, very well-made film, and a lot better than I suppose I was expecting, and I don't know why I put them off seeing it for so long.
Well, it is like a 3-hour-long Mozart film.
Yeah.
It's a very specific target audience.
Yeah.
It is beautiful, though.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful sort of... And it, even though it's not true to the historical record, I think it's true in its own way in that it sort of captures it.
Yeah.
It's a story that
it
wants to tell.
And I think the themes it hits on and that idea of working out, as I presume everyone does at some stage, that someone they know or a friend or sibling or someone... is just inherently better at something than you will ever be, and that kind of mild jealously, but also kind of wanting to support them sometimes, and just fantastic, and it was such a good way. And then on the topic of mild jealousy for a sibling who does something better than you, the other film I saw was Making the Grade, and I went to go to a director's commentary, and I suppose the sibling rivalry thing was because my brother is a genius at piano, whereas I can barely master chopsticks, and this has always been the way. So going along to Making the Grade was, in one sense, it was kind of funny going back to all those piano lessons, but I really liked it. I think it's a fascinating film that isn't so much about piano lessons as it is about Irish people and approaches and conversation, and the director is, I thought he was very good at capturing very particular nuances of speech and knowing to let them hang or cut there, and so that that particular, those particular words sort of like you remain, you think about them. It was really excellent, and I'd highly recommend Making the Great and Amadeus.
So Ken Larder, who directed Making the Great, His and Hers is the closest one to it, his first feature documentary, and it is similarly about the relationships between, in that case, between father or between mothers and sons, but this one between teacher and student. So he has a great eye for that sort of, and what makes that interesting. This is the first one time that he's worked with an editor, though, rather than editing his own stuff. So he did have help on this one, but then he, as he says himself, he could have either afforded a cinematographer or an editor, not both. So he's his own cinematographer in this, whereas before he's hired in cinematographers. But because of the nature of it, it has a fixed camera. It doesn't follow. It doesn't have a camera in motion. It doesn't need to have a camera in motion. The pianos don't move. That's one of the key things about them. So, but what he does with Making the Great is that he broadens the thing, because it could have so easily been about the relationships between teachers and students in a particular school or whatever, but this is all over the country, and you don't find out if any of them ever passed their exams.
Unless, like me, you went to the IFI screening with the director and put your hand up and said, did they pass?
Yeah. But
can I get a scorecard?
Yeah. It doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't. In the context of the film, it
has a lovely natural structure to it, because there's 8 grades of piano teaching, and therefore he goes from grade 1 through the whole way to grade 8, and so the music is constantly getting better in it as it goes.
The stakes
through.
Are getting higher. It's really well done.
Pitch, too.
So I think Made in Grace is an incredible film, but it's just that it's unfortunate that it's not getting the audience that it deserves.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a crowded season.
Yeah.
Very, very crowded season.
I think it's the one, like, the farthest was for me last year that I've been, like, shouting from the rooftops and being like, go see this film. I've been telling people in work, I've been telling everyone I run into.
Yeah, it's not quite the farthest.
No, it's not. But in terms of trying to get the word out on the thing.
Oh no, it is. I mean, I saw it last year at ADIF, and it stuck with me for a long, long time. And I'm still able to talk when I talk to Ken. I go with specific scenes, even though it was a year before.
Always a good sign.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. So anyway, we'll move on to the news, because mostly the big one that I watched this week was Ultron, and we talked about no, absolutely no problem, because I mean,
great minds.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was
I am the James Baker who is Robert Downey.
I watched a lot of television. I finished my now annual West Wing rewatch, and I watched
There's a relaunch coming, a revival, right?
Really?
I heard this.
There's Aaron Sorkin has been in talks about a potential new series or limited series of the West Wing, with starting Kay Brown as president.
Oh, this is the alternate world.
In the same way that I suppose this one was the alternate to...
Well, I mean, but Bartlett was very clearly like a slightly alternate, you know, Clinton, whereas this is like reality broken 2016.
World,
it's like, well, okay.
We're in Bizarro World.
I think Bizarro World is where we reside. This is like a glimpse into a saner world.
Well, it's even... to where you could take off 4 years into the Matt Santos presidency, so if you get Jimmy Smith's back and you talk about him running for
stress
years,
level wise, he probably would look out like as aged as 4 years of a president would probably do.
You also get back Bradley Cooper and you know, you bring Bradley Whitford,
I love the idea of like some Hollywood executive being, we like Bradley, but can we swap him out for Cooper?
Yeah. So you would get. That would be, you may still get them in terms of the idea with this is that it's 20 years after Bartlett.
20 years.
And that Bartlett is called in to help in a crisis, essentially. The way that Clinton used to call.
Great to see that MS diagnosis.
Super nostalgia. Not only are we like flashing back to the Obama era, we're flashing back to the Obama era, which is itself flashing back to the Clinton era.
Well, Clinton used to call Reagan for advice. So there is that.
Different times.
You know, imagine calling Ronald Reagan for advice. I mean, seriously. Something wrong.
Crazy thought. 8 years from now, somebody will be calling Trump for advice.
Nobody will be calling Trump for advice.
Maybe to do the opposite. Right? Yeah. It's confirmed, people.
Yeah, good call. Yeah.
What would you have done? Yeah. I'm not doing that. So, we'll move on to the news. There hasn't been a lot of big news this week. But we have some cool stuff happening in the world of Irish film. The Image You Missed, which is Donal Foran's excellent documentary, is going to have its North American premiere at the end of the week on Friday. It's playing in New York at the Art of the Real Festival at the Brooklyn. It's part of the Brooklyn Filmmakers Collective's and the Film Society of Lincoln Center's festival. So Donal Foran is a member of the Brooklyn Filmmakers Collective. He lives and works from New York, but so the film is about when his father died, and he didn't really know his father, but when he died, he left a bunch of material behind, because his father was a documentary filmmaker as well in Northern Ireland, and he had documented the troubles over the years, and so he left a huge amount of material, and so Donald goes through the material and makes a film of his findings and adds in some of his own and some new stuff, and it's a wonderful story in terms of an artist discovering more about himself through the process of filmmaking, and the footage is incredible, and what it says about Northern Ireland that was, and the sort of revolutionary activities in the world at large is still pertinent. So when it comes back, and when it comes out, because it played at ADIF, when it comes out here, I would recommend that a lot of that anyone
attention
go see, because it is an excellent documentary. At the end of this month, so we're now into May. So the end of this month is Fastnet Film Festival. It's the 10th anniversary of Fastnet Film Festival, and it's on in Skull in West Cork, and it is essentially one of the greatest film festivals in Ireland. They turn the entire village into cinemas, so every sort of public space is a cinema, so bars and the cafes or whatever become somewhere to show a film.
And just briefly on that, actually, I was in Cork yesterday and went to Spike Island, which is there, like they've done the prison up differently, and they're screening a screening of The General in Martin Cahill's former prison cell, like in 2 weeks time. I was like, wow.
In his prison cell.
In his, like, former.
What's the accommodation?
What's
the capacity?
That it's extremely small, as you'd imagine. But it just struck me as like a truly, like, wow.
Somebody does a
film festival programming. Yeah. That's pretty fantastic.
Yeah, someone does a Michael Collins in Kilmainham. I would be there.
Yeah.
You might have to fight for space, perhaps. But
you can do it in the big rotunda area.
I suppose.
Yeah. Where
the Panopticon, you're designed so you
can perfect screen Dublin Castle.
I think they did that a few years ago.
Did they?
A mob Michael Collins against Dublin Castle.
Ah, irony, it's fantastic.
Well, you're talking about films where historical narrative isn't really as important as the intent of
it's also arguably our only blockbuster. I mean, I know we all think about Taffin. Taffin was the first place that I went to, but yeah.
Well, in terms of telling an Irish story, yes, because we have said Ryan Braveheart.
Yeah, but they're
Excalibur, but
I suppose actually, yeah, even the money for Michael Collins was Foreign, wasn't it?
It was Universal.
Yeah. Was it Universal or Warner?
It was Warner. Sorry, Warner's, yeah. So it was, yeah. So
again, Irish talent and an Irish story.
Yeah. Somebody once saw Jurassic Park in a park and loved it. I would highly recommend
Jaws
it.
Jaws on the Beach is also a good one.
I'd imagine, actually.
So, Bord's going on here, and the Irish Film Board have announced two new appointments to their production development and distribution unit. So Emer Markey is coming in to be a new story consultant, which is she's going to work with the project managers on the scripts that are in development, towards the end of their development, in turn to help improve the quality of the scripts. And then Jennifer Smith, who's already been working with the IFP, has been moved to the new production and development coordinator. So she is going to manage the logistics of the production and development slate. So that Sarah Dillon was there, and she's now off managing the RAP funds, which are the ones responsible for Can with Horses, which is
the Barry Keoghan.
Very exciting. Yeah. Brian Gleeson has joined the cast of Death of a Ladies Man. So Death of a Ladies Man is going to be filmed here, and it's an Irish international co-production. It's got Gabriel Byrne in the lead. It's based on the Leonard Cohen song, and it's going to use Leonard Cohen songs throughout it. It's inspired by Leonard Cohen's work, and their management is Leonard Cohen's management is involved in it.
So what I'm hearing is it's like Mamma Mia, but with Leonard Cohen.
Yeah. Well, no, it's not.
I know.
The story is about.
I would be very surprised.
Gabriel Byrne plays a hard-drinking, womanizing university professor.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that.
So,
both as a Leonard Cohen adaptation and as one starring Gabriel Byrne.
Yeah, so the film is it will be filmed here and in Canada, and I really look forward to it. Breen is a great actor. So,
well, I like seeing Breen do some pop up in things where I don't expect him to be. It was a Phantom Thread where he has this role as a therapist and. It's like, is that Brian Gleeson? Yes, that's Brian Gleeson. Or, what was it?
Logan. Yeah, it took me a while to spot him there, but yeah, it's good.
There was a good solid 5 minutes of that can't be. That is.
Yeah. Fair play to him. Nailing the accent.
Yeah.
Just random, Andy Gleeson just turning up where you don't expect him to, like in Mother.
Yeah. Both with all your Gleesons, all your Gleeson needs.
So that's the news. They're the big ones. Oh no, sorry, Wildcard are going to release the Katie Taylor documentary this summer. They haven't dated it yet. It looks like it'll be towards the end of the summer. Katie Taylor to come back.
Yes,
so
yes.
Ross Whittaker has been working with Katie Taylor for the last number of years, since the Rio Olympics, and it's going to document what happened there in terms of her losing her Olympic title and then turning professional and subsequently winning 2 world titles. So she's now on her way to becoming the undisputed world champion. She has 2 of the 3 belts, so she's a unified world champion at the moment. She just won last weekend in a very impressive victory. It'd be interesting.
There's your happy ending.
Katie Taylor is a little bit of an enigma in some ways, because she's a deeply private person, so you don't really get to. She doesn't do a lot of interviews, and any ones that she does, she doesn't really speak that much in them. So it'll be interesting to see. Ross has got form in, of course, the boxing world, because his first one was based in the boxing movie Survivors, and then he also had
a surfing movie as well.
And that was his last one, Between Land and Sea, but he also did When Ali Comes to Ireland about Muhammad Ali, and then on the Unbreakable, the Mark Pollock story as well. So he's one of our best documentarians. I'm very excited to see this. He's very excited about it himself, so that's always a good sign.
Perfect. It sounds tailor-made.
Yay!
I'm here all week.
So on to the top 10. Very exciting. At 10, we have a Met Opera. Cendrillon, the Met Opera. I have no idea what Cendrillon is.
It's interesting, though, that these Met Operas, which, you know, are doing decent numbers.
It's an opera described as a fairy tale in 4 acts by Jules Massenet to a French libretto by Henry Kane. Of course, I know this off the top of my head. I'm not reading this from the screen in any description.
Yeah, but not my bag. But it also, because of because of what happened at number 1, the entry
the threshold for entry is much lower.
Very low. So it was the first time this year that anything that just grossed 20,000 has gotten into the charts. The low bar was in the 40,000s up until now.
Although, to be clear, Greatest Showman somehow isn't here.
Yes.
Despite being in last week.
Wow.
I know.
The Greatest Showman, it'll be back next week. So.
There is no stopping it. It is remorseless.
It is incredible, that film. But anyway, we almost went a week without bringing it up. At 9, Love, Simon, in its 4th week. So it's doing remarkably well.
I'm glad to see it doing remarkably well. I saw it in Swords a couple of weeks back, and there were a number of young, I'm assuming, gay couples there, and they seemed really, really affected by it, and that's what's important. It's also very funny and very well made. It's earned something close to, was it €378,000 to date? Which is impressive.
Yeah, for
a film, basically a teen romance film that had relatively little social media presence. I don't think it was a media phenomenon in the same way that, I don't know, Perks of Being a Wallflower would have been, or something like that.
Yeah, or any of the Dying Girl.
Yes, the Me and Earl and subgenre. But Love, Simon's great. It's very funny, it's very charming, it's got a great cast.
But it's also indicative of what happened earlier in the year, you know, in terms of Calling by Your Name doing as well as it did, you know,
the over such a long distance as well.
Exactly, yeah. Like, so these films have legs when they tell a story that engages with an audience. You know, so
that's been largely underserved and ignored, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, LGBT cinema has still got quite a way to come in terms of being more mainstream. You know, but
I love Silence is a big step in that direction, because it is a very mainstream sort of... It is almost a Sundance film, except it's good. It's got that sort of witty narration, it's got that wry sense of humour, got the quirky family around the hero, it's got the supporting cast who all have sort of defining traits. But it's very charming, it's very engaging. And Josh Duhamel still looks like somebody genetically like crossbred Bradley Cooper with Johnny Knoxville. Get that image out of your head.
At ease. The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society. What a title.
Oh, it's memorable. The title, not the film. People have asked me, what's the deal with the Potato Peel Pie movie?
Yeah.
And I feel really bad when I have to tell them it's not great.
Although, according to Rotten Tomatoes, it's amazing.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Because the British went nuts for it.
Did the British go nuts or did the Americans go nuts?
Oh, possibly it was both. Rotten Tomatoes anyway, it's doing far better than it should.
It has the look of a film that would do very well in America, where they're like, Royal Baby!
Yeah. And it has that sort of quaint title that would immediately, like, you know exactly what that film's going to be based on the combination of 15 words.
Sammy Fishing in the Yemen and...
Exactly.
What was that one? The tractor repair in Belarusian tractors or something? It was... not Belarusian tractors, because you actually can get Belarusian tractors.
Ukrainian tractors.
Zetas are better.
It's not a good film. It's very anemic. It's very dry. It's a story about, you know, visiting Guernsey after the Nazi occupation. It turns out that apparently there's a dark secret there that has to be investigated and uncovered. And the dark secret is how wonderful all these people are.
So it's a film about things not being so bad after the evil European forces are driven out and everyone gets along. Interesting.
Much better.
Brexit. The excellent.
That was the mercy earlier in the year, in which a man with no preparation and no foresight and no planning decides to venture out into the great Atlantic alone and discovers how deeply he is fucked. The Mercy is the best Brexit movie you will ever see.
I think I'll say that it is a bit peculiar that at this moment in time in the cinema we have a film set in Jersey and one set in Guernsey.
That's true, actually.
That is the Channel Islands.
This is their moment. They're channeling a lot of public enthusiasm.
I'm just waiting for one set on Sark and then we're set,
Barclay Brothers.
At seven, Duck Duck Goose.
I have not seen this, and somehow it's earned €584,000.
Children's animation.
Just print money, basically.
Well, the thing is, you brought them to see Coco, and you brought them to see Coco again, and at some point you have to branch out, and you've seen Peter Rabbit, and therefore you have to go see something else, and Duck Duck Goose is what there is. I brought my son a couple of weeks back to see Coco. He turned 3 at the weekend. He's still very, very young for this stuff. But he keeps asking me when we can go to the cinema again. So, I mean,
that's great.
Which is for me, is fantastic.
Absolutely.
But that means that I'm going to have to go see Peter Rabbit.
You could just push it out a little further. There's got to be one coming up. There's going to be like Sherlock Gnomes, which is apparently atrocious.
No.
But has a great pun.
Sherlock Gnomes?
The sequel to Romeo and Juliet.
They had me at the title Sherlock Gnomes. I was on board the moment I heard that.
I wonder how many other books they're going to use for times for gnome things. Gnome Country for Old Men.
Come on, tell me you wouldn't watch that. With Tommy Lee Gnomes.
Absolutely watch that.
Yeah.
No.
No.
At six,
Brando.
Truth or Dare.
Take Andrew to see this.
I'm not taking Andrew to see a bad horror film.
Apparently it's not great. My younger sister went to see it, and despite the fact that she is quite fond of terrible horror movies, this is apparently a terrible, terrible horror movie. It's not even a good, terrible horror movie, which is a shame, because...
It's Blumhouse. From them,
I mean, they've got a lot of credibility with Get Out and stuff, but in terms of their earlier productions, weren't they doing... I know they weren't Platinum Dunes level, but, don't they have a somewhat questionable... reputation.
I got all excited when I saw it was written by Gillian Jacobs, and then was like, "Oh wait, not that Gillian Jacobs."
It's like when Bill Murray signed up for Garfield because it was written by Ethan Coen.
Yeah.
Not that Ethan Coen.
No, it's too late now.
I would love to see a Coen. Yeah, but you still didn't have to sign for the sequel, Bill. I would love to see a Coen Brothers Garfield movie.
Yeah, that would be peculiar.
Sorry. While I'm pitching things that will never happen.
Mat 5, Blockers.
Charming little.
I've heard this is better than a lot of the marketing would maybe lead you to believe.
It is. It's
better than the film with John Cena in deserves to be.
Hey. A Trainwreck was quite good. It was far too long, but Trainwreck was quite good. Yeah. That had John Cena in it, right?
Yes. That was, yeah, but far too long.
Oh, fine. But yeah, Blockers is good. It's surprisingly open-minded, sex-positive, feminist, and progressive for a movie that features butt-chugging.
Mm-hmm.
It's gross-out comedy. It's unashamed of the gross-out comedy. Commits to being a gross-out comedy. There's no chance that anybody going to see it will be like, ah, this is a much more enlightened and, you know, intelligent and informed movie than I thought it was going to be. But there is a chance that people watching it will absorb a message that is perhaps more progressive and sex-positive than most of these sort of movies you would expect them to be. And it has a charming cast, including, yes, John Cena, because the film pitches itself. It understands the appeal of Cena. It's not that he's like the Laurence Olivier of his time. It's that he gives very good reaction shots. So you get a number of really good close-up reaction shots. In fact, one of the better gags in the film is a reaction shot shared between him and Gary Cole, and it's just beautiful. It's just beautiful.
Gary Cole is very good at
at reaction shots as well. I mean, you know, you got the niche there.
It's the commentator in Dodgeball. It's just
and the father in Talladega Nights, which is available on Netflix from this Friday.
That is my Friday night sorted.
Yeah, well, not to spoil the, you know, upcoming movie section, but that might not be the worst choice.
At 4, Peter Rabbit. So I'll report back on this next week.
Someone will find
me. Good luck with that.
I got it.
Yes,
thank you.
At 3, Rampage.
I actually saw Rampage, mostly because we went to see something else and the time was wrong and we were like, well, this one's starting now, can't be that bad. And it wasn't that bad. It's relatively fun. It doesn't take itself remotely seriously from the very start of the
It's
sort of
The
like,
Rock and a giant
exactly.
gorilla.
And Ernest, please, if I just want to know what happened to my friend.
Yeah.
Or the moment where his best human friend grabs him and goes, that's not the George we know.
Yeah. There's a lot of that.
Yeah. And it works really well.
In terms of tone, it just like nails it. You realize like they've got, as soon as they get the tone right, it's fine, you know?
It's just a shame about the name, when you could have called it Furious George. Or We Fought a Zoo.
But I don't know, I thought the tone was a bit off. Like, I quite liked all that earnest, sweet stuff, or the moment where like two separate human characters walk up to The Rock and say, how come you don't like people much? But it's the bit where you get like the Man of Steel level urban destruction. That
I was going to say, there must be, and there were a lot of kids especially in this, and I was thinking, you know, 9/11 was a big event in my life, but for kids who are growing up post 9/11, it's like every single superhero now just regularly destroys a city. That's what happens. I can remember when Independence Day was a big deal when they like destroyed things. And similarly, I was looking at something like Rampage, which quite literally a whole city block is almost leveled. And just it becomes so kind of like, oh yeah, sure, we'll put that back up afterwards. In fact, the monkey can probably help us. Sorry, the ape will probably
help us. There's a scene where like people are pulling survivors from the rubble in slow motion, covered in dust, evoking 9/11, and then you have the monkey making a sex joke.
Yeah, nearly immediately after. Yeah.
But the thing about Independence Day was it actually showed some of the people who, and the fact that they met their end. And so I mean, it set up the consequence and showed the aftermath. Awful lot of these ones, especially Man of Steel, did not do at all. It's like, oh look, we've just destroyed 50 skyscrapers, but no, there's not a mention of any people at all in this.
Not to go down the Batman versus Superman tangent, but I like the opening scene just because
that is,
of that.
And the fact that it syncs perfectly to the end of Man of Steel.
It's basically like you want a 9/11 superhero movie. Well, this should be the end of 9/11 superhero movies. It won't be, but it should be.
Rampage is basically
9/11 is now a verb.
9/11'd.
Yeah, they 9/11'd Asgard in the Dark World, for example.
Mm.
Yeah.
Not the Dark, Ragnarok.
No, Dark World. They 9/11'd with the fighter jet into the...
Oh, okay, right, yes. Okay, yeah. No, I was thinking...
It's shaped like a literal sword. So you listeners can't see, but I'm gesturing.
Making a sword
movement. Making a sword movement.
Yeah, the Rampage, if anyone's played the video game, it's just bizarre that this is a film.
It's probably one of the better video game adaptations
of the low bars. Yeah. I mean, it's no Edge of Tomorrow, which is still the best video
it's
game.
It's not a
ever.
Video game. It takes video game mechanics and applies them to a movie. It's not.
Yeah.
And that's the best.
No, I fully agree, but I also think it is
it's Prince of Persia mechanics. No.
What is interesting is that, like, for so long you've been seeing these overly complicated video
Tomb Raider,
game
for example.
Yeah, or Assassin's Creed, where they almost get lost in the mythology of the video game, and thinking fans want to see this. Whereas a film like Rampage is just like, oh, no, it's just a Rampage.
Yeah. But that's
literally just something getting
Assassin's
smashed.
Creed could have been so good, though.
The issue with Tomb Raider and Assassin's Creed is they're video game movies for people who like video game cutscenes.
Yeah.
Whereas this is like video games for people like hitting the controller really hard and seeing what happens.
Button mashing.
But that's the worst problem of most video game adaptations is that it feels like you're on Twitch watching somebody else play a video game. Mm. And that, then why would you leave the house? Because you can do that at home. And why are people on Twitch watching other people play video games?
I don't understand kids either now.
No, I mean... I like gaming. I like the walkthroughs. I like being shown by the YouTube video tutorials that get me past the part that I'm stuck in. But watching somebody else play a video game for an extended period of time, I'm just
so let's play. Is that the term that's used? Very big on YouTube. No, Darren, it's Miss Pop Culture.
I don't know. Twitch is more.
Isn't that the one where your man used the N-word? Tweety Pie.
PewDiePie. Is that his name?
PewDiePie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
We are hip and happening at the Scannon Podcast, which is available on the internet.
At two, A Quiet Place.
Oh yeah.
Bang! Oh no!
I do love and I.
Last week was very interesting. The Quiet Place. The first people to bring Quiet Place backlash onto
the podcast. Yeah.
Who didn't like it?
Take a guess.
Jay
and
Ronan
were not big fans of it. But it's. I don't know if this is true, and if it's not true, I don't want people to tell me that it's not true. But I love the Instagram photo of Michael Bay looking at the Platinum Dunes logo and the 100% on Rotten Tomatoes and going, this never happens. But it's a delightful film. It's a delightful film. Very clever, very old-fashioned, very sort of...
Is it being undermined a little by the fact there's a sequel coming?
Well, I mean, lots of great horror movies have terrible sequels and it doesn't undermine them. Like, Halloween is still a great movie.
And there's a new one coming.
The Danny McBride one I saw.
But that's an interesting combination.
That's a really weird combination.
Left field right there.
These Bound and Down guys are doing the new Halloween. And it's just called Halloween and stars Jamie Lee
Curtis. Yeah, Jamie Lee Curtis is back.
Please, the star of the star of Your Highness, if you will.
I really liked Your Highness.
I liked Your Highness too.
Phil Norgren.
That was a good press junket as well. Danny McBride was in a great form.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, we were. Were we nice head?
He was
I was there too, though.
That's weird. We were probably
there. I never knew
and didn't know.
Danny McBride bringing people together.
Yeah, that was a fun evening. And number one, Avengers Infinity War, with 82% of the box office taking 1.56 million over 3 days and almost just shy of 2 million over the four
and
days.
And earning Justice League's entire box office in the space of 4 or 5 days?
Yeah.
Wow.
538 million to date or something.
This is Marvel's world. We just live in it. And I love the fact that spoilers are still going to be a thing, even though everybody on the planet must have seen this like 5 times already, statistically speaking.
Yeah, I haven't.
I know, I'm not going to spoil it.
It is one to like... It's interesting because... Maybe it's because I'm older or something, but I think the lead up to it in the immediate discussions, even in like after the weekend it's come out, is it's sort of, as you said, something that you're almost obligated to see.
Yeah.
And I remember, even with something like Avatar, there was like a building or something at the time where people would sort of say like, oh yeah, you know, and people would start talking about it as this like event cinema nearly everyone sort of, whereas this one, as you say, it's almost obligatory. It's like, oh no, you have to go see that.
Oh no, one of our panelists who is here today texted me and apologized that he couldn't make it because he hadn't seen Infinity War. So he will hopefully have seen it next week.
Yeah.
So that's where he is.
I don't know if he's there right now, but that may be where he's going.
Has anyone seen him? Apologize if you've already given
up
about this. I know that, I mean the film. I meant the new cinema in Parnell Street.
That oh, the 4DX.
A roller coaster and the cinema.
At the same time. Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to subject Jason to it.
Fantastic. That's great.
Jay is cinemas of experience. That's what we're pitching it as. You have these.
Does he know? Like,
yeah.
Like bringing. Oh, it's a normal cinema.
He has reluctantly agreed to try all of these newfangled things.
It's like Yes Man, but with terrible ideas. It's fantastic. It's like
Darren is going to curate a series of films for him to watch as well.
It's like those. Those articles you read, like I lived on Nutella for a week. Mm. This is modern journalism. Mm. This is where we're at. So I'm thinking about like. I'm gonna, modify and sort of like I'm gonna modernize Jay a good 10%. I'm gonna like extremize him by a good 5%. We're gonna radicalize. Can't use radicalize anymore.
No.
But
we're not going to radicalize that Marxism.
New and improved. I haven't seen it in 4DX. I've seen it twice already because I'm doing a separate thing on it and I kind of have to.
It's almost as if it entered the 250.
Yeah, it's almost as if it's the 9th greatest movie of all time. So, if you want to hear me talk about this in great depth...
In comparison to the other 10, yeah. Wow.
Yeah, it's astounding. It's a cultural event. It is surprisingly earnest in the idea of Marvel movies as a television show. In particular, this is like a bloodless PG-13 version of Game of Thrones, where you have a huge cast that across a huge geographical distance and you cut between them, except because this is only 3 hours long, everyone's all like, hey, we should probably do something about the White Walkers about midway through the first episode. It's grand. It's impressive that it works at all, let alone that it coheres in any sort of rational way, but it does that at the cost of being about anything except itself. It's a movie that, like, you had the two last Marvel movies, which were, like, Black Panther and, like, Thor Ragnarok, were bold and ambitious and, like, did things that were relatively new and exciting for the franchise. This is just there. And that's grand, and it's good that they managed to do it. I'm impressed. I would like love to see a documentary about like them moving cards across walls, saying, "Well, we have Bradley Cooper for 3 days," or "Well, we can't do that."
So you want the first AD experience on?
Yeah, I would love to imagine what it would be like to organize something like this. And in fact, I actually like I have great fun going online and reading like our interviews with the writers and directors on Vulture. So
the first AD, that's who you want to talk to. Then
the sheer mechanics of everything. Because it is, it's a fantastic logistical accomplishment. It's amazing that it got made. I just wish it were
better.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But
to go back to that Game of Thrones metaphor, in terms of almost every series of Game of Thrones, episodes 8 and 9 are better than 10.
Yeah.
The setup,
yeah.
And then there's payoff.
It's structured... Without getting, because people are still very sensitive about spoilers, and I think that's something that's very telling about this movie, but we won't go into that now. But the in terms of structure, it's even structured like a mini-season of Game of Thrones, where the opening couple of episodes or scenes of the film are structured in such a way as to say, we mean business and we're catching your attention. So you get like this big, jumpy, almost like bloodletting, sort of like, oh, it's really serious this time.
Mm.
Then you have like the middle stretch of the season where everybody's sort of diffused and everybody's like, oh, what the hell's going on? Oh, we're going to have fun character interactions. We're going to throw people together and have them interact. And then at the end you have, oh, by the way, this big serious thing is happening that, completely throws your understanding of what's just happened on the way. And you have this, so it is very much like a TV show, but condensed down. It's really, really, really weird.
Mm.
And it's kind of strange because in theory, a large part of the appeal of a movie like this is taking all your favorite characters and putting them in a movie together where they interact. But because the plot is so complicated, because time is so limited, and because you have to race towards the finish, none of the characters have any agency or choice in the narrative. none of the characters in the movie actually make a decision, which is remarkable. And it's very inhuman, and it's very weird, and it's... There's a sequence where, without getting too spoiler, you end up with, like, Tony Stark, Peter Parker, and Peter Quill on a planet together, and their dialogue is just quips and one-liners and pop culture references, and you're like, yeah, these are largely indistinguishable from one another, aside from the fact that, you know, one of them's a teenager, one of them has a goatee, and the other one has sideburns. And it just, it's strange. It's really strange that you would have the whole point of having a massive crossover and, like, not bounce the balls off one another in, like, a serious way. Yeah. I talked about Age of Ultron. Age of Ultron is a thing where, like, the characters act in the way that they act like characters. They make bad decisions and at certain points want to murder each other. Whereas here, they're just like, hey, it's that guy. I met you at the work Christmas party a couple of years ago.
Yes, he's a friend from work.
pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's, you know, you probably have to go and see this.
Yeah.
But I just wish it were better. And I mean, it's not bad. It's,
yeah.
But it's not good.
Interesting.
I'll report back when I eventually see it, hopefully next week.
And in 4DX with the...
I'm not going with those.
Oh, that's
the wires kind of, everywhere.
That's going to be one of my experiences. I hope you get a little scent of lavender whenever Thanos walks on screen.
I've seen a Shrek film in Los Angeles once in 4DX where, like, when Shrek sneezes, you get a spray of snot all over your face.
Was that not a theme park ride?
Yes, it was.
And there's one where rats run at you.
And then there's, like, wires and goes... Yeah. And it does, and for a 20-minute theme park ride Shrek film, it certainly worked. I just don't know if I'll be able to...
Sustain.
Like, I imagine there are emotional beats in these films that, you know, what's happening then? Bubbles are being passed out? And
I like the idea of, like, setting the chair, you know, from, like, you know, random violence to emotional devastation.
Yeah.
That's your...
Feel this now. Now
yeah.
Feel this.
Your 4DX experience in a Michael Haneke film, for example, where it's just like, we set the chairs to soulless depression. It's,
Enter the Void or something.
Yeah.
Gaspar Noé's Love, I think.
Yeah. Our 50 Shades of Grey, it's like, that's not water. Anyway, on to the new releases. So, first out of the gate is, you saw it last night there, was it? I Feel Pretty.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Is that any good?
It's not great. It's an interesting premise. It has the same sort of issue that Snatched has, which is, Amy Schumer is a very funny comedian, and she's very clever, and she's very wry, and she works very well with her own material, and her approach to comedy is largely based on subversion or deconstruction. So it's largely picking apart the things that you accept to be true and you know, sort of playing with these sort of social notions. And so you have I Feel Pretty, which is a comedy which is in some ways structured as a play on the classic body transformation comedies, like, for example, 13 Going on 30 with Jennifer Garner, where a 13-year-old kid wakes up and finds herself 30 years old, or Big, which actually appears in the movie, where, you know, Tom Hanks wakes up and is suddenly older. And in fact, Big plays a role in informing the character's decision.
Shallow Hal, to an extent.
Yeah, well, Shallow Hal is, we'll get to that. So Schumer's character, who is ugly, nominally speaking, according to the logic of the film, and so has all these self-esteem issues tied to that. She watches Big. She makes a wish that she could be pretty. And so what happens is, through a series of freak accidents at her soul cycle class, a horrible accident occurs, and she wakes up, and she's suddenly beautiful. Except it's only in her own head.
Okay.
Which is an interesting deconstructive beat on that sort of classic comedy setup. It's like this character who believes they are one thing while everybody else knows and perceives them as something else, right?
Especially now, when the, like, as you sort of say, it's a nominal maybe distinction. It's not like you have a 12-year-old boy who's now on a corporate board, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, there are many people out there who find Amy Schumer quite attractive.
Yeah.
So,
it's a strange one.
It's a very, very strange pitch. And the movie never quite settles on a tone. It's never sure whether it's laughing with her or at her.
Okay.
And so you have this weird thing where you have, like, this self-empowerment message about how she only needs to learn to love herself, and that's all that matters, coupled with this strange second act romantic comedy beat where it's like, oh, she's pretty now, so she doesn't have time for her uggo friends. and you have this sort of thing that runs that runs throughout, where like at the same time, well, you've got this whole arc about how beautiful people completely ignore ugly people and are genuinely horrible to them. But because this is an uplifting and life-affirming film, we also get several scenes in which the troubles of pretty people are explored. There is genuinely, without any sense of irony, a riff on that great scene from Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, where Drax says, "When you are ugly, you know that someone loves you for who you truly are. When you're pretty, you don't know who to trust." From a handsome male co-star sitting in her bedroom, practically ready to cry. There's a moment where, her pretty sort of soul cycle friend who's like, "Oh my god, it's so tough being pretty. I have all these self-esteem issues." So you have this weird dissonance where the movie is what it needs to be from moment to moment in order to be an aspirational comedy, but none of those things cohere into anything resembling a narrative. Like, there's a moment at the end where one of the characters, where you have this big inevitable, like, she has the beauty taken away from her, but she learns to believe in herself. And one of the supporting characters, played by Michelle Williams, who is criminally underused. I know.
Wow.
If this were a better film, this would be like Tom Cruise in Tropic Thunder. Because she's playing like a ditzy, high-pitched fashion, like magazine mogul. And it's like, if this were a better film, you would give Michelle Williams something to do other than have a high-pitched voice and like dance through the office. And the film doesn't give her anything to do. But after this big aspirational life-affirming moment, she points out the company health plan does cover psychiatric and mental health issues as well. And you're like, what is the tone here?
Yeah.
Am I cheering at this affirmation that the character has gone through, or am I acknowledging that this is a really traumatic psychiatric experience for everybody involved?
Wow, right.
What are you doing in this film? What are you trying to do? It doesn't work.
Much like, I mean, it sounds like Shallow Gal. It sounds like very similar to Shallow Hal.
It's better than Shallow Hell, because at least
there's no Jack Black.
But it also doesn't have the same gross out humor. It isn't quite as mean spirited. It seems like Shallow Hell is incredibly vindictive.
That's a dark film.
It's a very dark, very twisted, very bitter piece of filmmaking. The mistakes in this film seem to largely result from the fact that on a scene to scene basis they were like, "Schumacher, do some comic riffs. You're very good at improvisation." And all of Schumer's comic riffs are, "This is a horrible premise." And somehow they make it into the final cut of the film. Yeah, there's a really great moment where they have the inspirational montage that you usually have in these films, and it just cuts to silence so you can see the character dancing in the way to the music that the audience could hear up until the second, which is a very clever cut.
Yeah.
But
it doesn't work
with like this idea that we're meant to be on board with this self-actualization sort of vibe the film's going for.
Right.
Okay. Have its cake and eat it. Not to make a fat joke.
Also out this week, Mary and the Witch's Flower. So this is going to play in a number of the Access Cinema locations around the way. Recently played Japanese Film Festival.
And Adif as well. That was one of the films that was cancelled and rescheduled. Oh no, it aired in its original
time. Yeah, it was part of the children's film strand that Adif runs. Japanese animation, wonderful looking film. Graham of this parish is a big, big fan of it. He's promoting it very much so. I haven't seen it yet, but I really do look forward to seeing it.
There's your accessible children's film. Right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, actually, yeah.
If I can find
where it's playing, then yeah, I might bring the little.
I was in an Isle of Dogs screening recently, and they turned to their kids, the family in front of me, and like, "Did you like it?" And the kids were like, "I don't know what I thought about that."
Yes, that's yourself.
Perfect. That is, yeah. Wes Anderson. I want to expose my child to a thing that my wife does not like. That's a good plan.
I quite like the story to somebody whose observation was that the great thing about Wes Anderson making an animated film is that it looks just like his live action films.
Well, yeah, because he frames it like that. So yeah. Also out this week, The Strangers Pray at Night. There's a new Strangers film.
The original Strangers, one of the best films of the 2000s.
How many have they made now of The Strangers?
This is only the first sequel, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know if there was another one.
Which is
was the middle one in there.
Okay, well, it's a very strange revival. It's 12 years after
the fact.
And The Strangers was always a bit of a cult hit. It was like funny games, but for people who don't like metafiction, basically. Which is great, because I'm kind of in that crowd. But
10 years. 08.
08.
For The Strangers, yeah.
Oh, cool. Which is great, because The Strangers then sort of ties into the whole mortgage crisis, home invasion thing going on. And it's very timely and very clever.
Yep.
This is
the only sequel.
Yeah, Pray at Night is not. Pray at Night is, yeah, somebody at some point decided Friday the 13th Part 2 was a good film and then decided that we were going to emulate it. It's like the ugly slasher movie counterpart to The Conjuring. You know, those sort of like James Wan sort of nostalgic sort of 70s horror movie stuff, except with Friday the 13th Part 2, which, to reiterate, is not a good movie. But it's got this really awkward vibe where it's like part nostalgic, part old-fashioned. Like, the soundtrack includes Kids in America and Total Eclipse of the Heart and all this sort of stuff. But it's somehow also set in the present day. But it's also at a holiday camp, because they still exist, I think.
To do.
Okay, do this?
Yeah, they still exist, yeah.
Okay, but it's basically, and it's a trailer park, and there's, you know, that's hunting funny. And stuff.
Sounds quite different to The Strangers.
It's very strange. It's very different to The Strangers. The Strangers was a much cleverer, much more timely film. Mm. This is very much a nostalgia boom. But it's a nostalgia boom not for the 2008 film that's a sequel to.
Yeah.
It's a nostalgia boom to those grotty 80s video nasty sort of things. And it's grand on those terms. It's perfectly forgettable. There's deaths, carnage, horror, suffering, death. I think I mentioned death already. But yeah, it's got this sort of, yeah, this sort of grotty vibe, which is grand, but when you're looking at cinema that recently has had, like, Ghost Stories was very good, and A Quiet Place is still performing at cinemas, horror can do much better, has done much better, and is doing.
And The Cure
much
didn't
better.
Get the...
The Cure, yeah, The Cure, is out, I think it may still be out in the moment. That's much better film, much more interesting film. I mean, even the Lodgers as well, if we're talking about Irish horror in particular, is very good. Like, yeah, there's a wealth of great stuff that is better than this. Revenge is coming out next week or the week after, I think, and is a much better example of what this is trying to do, which is to do a retrograde sort of blood and guts sort of, like, horror, brutality, sort of violent film that looks great.
It only cost $5 million to make. It made 25 in the US, so it is a success in terms of.
There'll be another Strangers in 10 years.
Christina Hendricks needs a new.
She really needs a better agent.
Yeah.
She really needs a better agent.
And then last but not least, the other release of next week is, or of this week, is Tully.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't seen this.
Yeah, so Graham has, and he again reports back saying that it is very good. He says that there's a chance that it will split audiences. I suppose it depends what you bring into it. So it is very much the tale of a mother undergoing the pressure of being a mother. And that being depicted on screen, you know, so...
I think Donald Clark, the Irish Times, described it as the Mary Poppins, we need to talk about Kevin mashup that you never knew you needed.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was so...
That sounds great.
But I mean, it reminds you when you say splitting audiences of, was it Killing of a Sacred Deer last year? Where we had the discussion where everybody in the podcast loved it, except for the person who was an actual parent.
Interesting. I haven't been sold on some of his recent one stuff. It's Jason Reitman.
Yeah, Jason Reitman, Juno fame.
The one he did, yeah, I think he had a great run of Up in the Air.
With Charlize, with Young Adults.
And
well.
Young Adults,
yeah.
And I really liked. And then it was the Adam Sandler one that kind of made me think, is this Emperor's New Clothes?
What was
that one? Other People or something?
Yeah, it was or even like Other People's Line. I can't remember.
Okay.
It was
something about people who are not.
Yeah. Terrible.
Yeah, it was during a boom of Adam Sandler terrible films with The Cobbler and other things.
I suppose.
I love the idea of Sandler having this sort of gravity where he just draws good directors
in.
A
black hole.
Talent, nothing can escape its surface.
Except Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah, yeah, PTA is good. Yeah.
I don't think we should call that the Paul Thomas Anderson Challenge. It's like, can you make a good movie with Adam Sandler? Except Bangbrick just about pounces.
Bangbrick,
sorry.
So Tully, I don't know if I want to watch it.
I'm curious about it.
I don't know if I want to see that reflected back at me on...
I
am a parent of two small children. I know what it's like to be a parent.
I suspect if it's Mary Poppins meets We Need to Talk About Kevin, I would hope that it's not your life reflected back at you.
Well, yes, yeah, yeah. But I don't know if that's something that I would...
No, I know what you mean. Yeah. there are some films that even people say, oh, it's great, you should go check that out. You'd like it because it's something you do in real life. And you're like, no, that's just the reason not.
Yeah, that's why.
As a law person, I never want to see Michael Clayton.
Yeah. Or The Accountant.
I remember watching
Well, there are other reasons I don't want to see The Accountant. The Accountant's great fun.
Actually, nowadays, I'm not an accountant. So
and
care.
Probably accountants would like that. Black whole like other life to accounting.
Black hat. Because it does not accurately reflect anybody who's ever worked with computers, ever.
Unlike all the other movies about people who have worked.
Although The Net is brilliant.
My favourite one is that in Mission Impossible, if you watch the first one, Tom Cruise, his typing speed is outstanding. He's like typing away really fast.
Why dangling from the ceiling?
And then it says, insert password, and he goes to one finger's beep, boop, boop, boop. And you realise he was just typing buttons, and then when he has to type the password, he goes like...
But there's one in... It was a news report, and they were showing a guy, and he was meant to be looking up records. I think it was on a police computer or something. And he's there, and his hands do not touch the keyboard.
Mozart,
it's like, lads, just go through the motions. Oh, I don't know. Yeah, no, but computer programming has never ever been properly. Oh, the fifth estate was the worst.
Oh,
the fifth estate is the one with Benedict Cumberbatch. Yes. But I mean, hold on, you say that as if the computer aspects of like
well,
the fifth
no, the journal, the, how they were representing online journalism, you know, or that sort of, you're like, oh my god.
It is interesting that they have, there are some, you know, we are so visually dyed in cinema that it's actually extremely difficult when you have to sort of show another screen. And like the classic thing I think seen recently is when the texts now the standard thing is
the Sherlock
thing that's taken over to the point where we just think, oh yeah, that person's getting a text and I can see it and they can see it and
that was Moffat's one of Moffat's great innovations. I mean, I think that is it Unfriended? There's one of I want to be careful now because there are two horror movies with a similar premise and one of them is abysmal. So I don't want to recommend that one. But there was Friend Request and Unfriended, which came out at the same time.
Yes.
I think it's Friend Request is the one that unfolds entirely within a user's desktop.
Yes.
Which is very clever. And I actually really, really love the movie. And I thought that was a way that you can do this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Because it's all within a Skype chat, so you get the person talking, but then you get like navigating through, you get loading videos, you get sending files, you get text messages down on the screen.
That's the multi-screening or the multi-task experience. You put the person's image up into the corner and you show the other stuff that's happening.
It's funny,
on the screen. That's,
we were talking about video game movies, like watching somebody play a video game. This is watching somebody operate a computer, but it's fascinating.
But it can be compelling if it's telling a story.
Yeah. And it probably costs like, you know, a couple hundred grand to do. It's nothing.
Yeah. That's it. On your representation of your life back at you when it's done wrong is really, really strange.
Yeah.
Because you can't help but criticise it. It's like the thing when you see an Irish film and the geography of Dublin is wrong. You're like, oh my god, how...
Thank you, Soderbergh, for stopping her action sequence so the leads could get in a taxi and pick it up where you wanted to.
Yeah.
I really appreciate
that.
Yeah,
no, Haywire is brilliant for that. Yeah. It is the best example of how to use Dublin geography correct. What If is the worst? Because in the journey from Dublin Airport to Balls Bridge, he crosses the Liffey about four times.
Yeah.
Like, what if it's Daniel Radcliffe?
Yeah.
I like what if.
Yeah, but no.
But I think you accept that. You imagine that every other country has that with their geography.
Oh, yeah, no, you do. But I mean, in terms of it, you seeing it and it being blatantly obvious, that's why you can't cross the river that many times getting from the airport
to
Balls Ridge.
Maybe he had a bad taxi driver. Maybe he was,
The one I always get is because I grew up in Toronto and you're looking at the gritty New York police detective solving the thing and you're like, no, that's the CN Tower behind you. That's just Toronto.
Oh, yeah.
That always takes me out immediately. Yeah.
Suits
is
entirely set in Toronto and is in New York and yet they're, at one point, they're outside the Roy, what's his name, center, which is iconically round.
Oh, the
Skydome
thing?
No, not the it's the theatre. The Roy something Hall.
Yeah.
Roy Thompson Hall.
Yeah.
And it has an iconic shape. And they're right outside it, and I don't know where that's meant to be in New York. And you're like, I was on set for The Incredible Hulk, and it filmed on Yonge Street as Harlem.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, this is...
Not the biggest problem with The Incredible Hulk.
No, but I mean, it is bizarre when they try to double some cities. Like, Vancouver is everywhere.
Vancouver, the issue with Vancouver can be everywhere except the desert.
Yeah. Vancouver, yeah, because nobody knows what the skyline of Vancouver looks like. Whereas Toronto has the CN Tower and the Sky Dome or Rogers Centre. Yeah. So those are very obvious things. Like, it is bizarre. Mm-hmm. The one that I really love is how Jack Reacher uses Pittsburgh. Because it comes in properly over the bridge with the... And so it follows the true... And it is very representative of that city, and without being a city that anyone really knows in terms of what it looks like.
I'll always make an argument for just looked up that Jason Reitman film. It's Men, Women, and Children.
Okay. But maybe that's something to do with people.
There's a really good series of shots in Ocean's 12, I believe it is.
Oh, God.
Putting the film aside, the establishing shots of each city they're in is actually done extremely well. Like, there's a wonderful bit where they are in Paris, but the Eiffel Tower is reflected in Brad Pitt's sunglasses at the side rather than, like, Soderbergh saying, "And now we're here in Paris." And it was very clever, but obviously the rest of the film, not so clever.
The establishing...
Well, or too clever.
If you're talking about establishing shots of a city in anything, that's Soderbergh, brilliant side effects. But I love the tracking shot into Hong Kong in The Dark Knight. And because having lived there, you know things about the city and it just, yeah, it's like, oh yeah, that's...
I mean, like the use of Chicago in those movies as well. Like, to the point where he doesn't disguise it. There's a moment where where Batman's charging at the Joker down the street and it's got the Chicago Coffee Company in the middle of a static shot.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is, Seattle's best is everywhere, so it's not the...
Yeah,
it uses Manhattan in The Dark Knight Rises when they're hanging people off bridges in Pittsburgh, and it is just Manhattan. They haven't even discovered anything. But the one that always gets me is in The Muppets Most Wanted, when it's doing an overhead shot of Dublin. I remember looking at it and thinking, that looks beautiful. And it's because they green-screened in beautiful oak trees along the Liffey to make Dublin look prettier, presumably.
It's amazing.
And more glamorous. And it looks great.
But it also, yeah, with Hugh Bonneville as the... Hugh Bonneville and Tom Hollander as theatre agents at the Abbey, I believe, at Gaiety.
Well, yeah, maybe that does check out. Probably a lot of West Brits there.
And on that note, we'll leave it there for the week. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
See you
next
week.
I never forget the first moment when I walked in Kyo Cinema. I was hooked from there on.